While we wait for people to get here, there was a story from the canon, or a commentary to the canon. Beautiful story. The Buddha was meditating at Uruvela under the Bodhi tree for a very long time, wrestling with how to become awakened. And this was before he had recollected his experience of jhana. So he had gone through very austere practices. And he was on the verge of death, but he looked kind of otherworldly. And nearby there was a great lady named Sujata. And Sujata had been trying to conceive a child. Her maid said, there is a tree deva under this tree. And it said that if you make an offering to the tree deva, you'll conceive. Sujata was wealthy. She had a dairy farm. So it said that she milked 100 cows and gave the milk of those cows to 50 cows. And then she milked those 50 cows and gave that milk to 20 cows. And then she milked those 20 cows and gave the milk to 10 cows. And so on and so forth until she milked the final cow and it came out pure cream. And with this cream, she made kiribat rice pudding. And she put this rice pudding in a golden bowl and offered it to the tree deva, had her maid bring the golden bowl of kiribat of rice pudding to the tree deva, who happened to be the Buddha. And the Buddha had reached the limit of austerities and said, this is not the right way. My body is exhausted and I'm on the verge of death. What if I take some food and jump in the river and get myself back together in body before continuing the practice? And so he opened his eyes and there was this bowl of milk rice waiting for him. Great generosity from Sujata. And he ate the milk rice and he was left with a golden bowl. And he said, I'm going to throw this golden bowl into the river. And if this golden bowl floats upstream rather than going downstream, I will attain awakening. And if it goes downstream, I will not. And of course, we know what happened to the bowl, right? The story of the generosity of Sujata is very much woven into the Buddha's own awakening. So you never know when you're generous to someone where it will lead.
And was she able to conceive?
Yes, and she conceived a child. She did indeed. We're going to discuss the jhanas this morning. And my approach to the jhanas can sound a bit different. It's not essentially different, but the approach may sound different. The path, of course, leads to one place. There are many different approaches. Ayakima said, a method is a method by any name. And we are using a method here, the method of the Brahmaviharas, a powerful method to take us to awakening, to take us to cessation. But one of the distinguishing features of that path is that the Brahmaviharas are the object of meditation. The jhanas just happen. So we don't put our attention on the jhanas, on the jhanic factors, which we're going to go over. Instead, we keep our attention on radiating whatever Brahmavihara, metta, karuna, compassion, mudita, joy, equanimity. These are the objects of meditation. But the Brahmaviharas are not just like any other object of meditation. The Brahmaviharas and the jhanas are part of a partition of the teaching known as the Chetta Vimutti, the liberation of the heart. There is no wisdom without liberation of the heart. If we recapitulate the Noble Eightfold Path, which we should because we're at the point in the gradual training where we're going to discuss the jhanas and the final moments of the path, the wisdom that comes from it, it becomes clear. In the Great 40, Majjhima Nikaya number 117, it says quite clearly, quite explicitly, that the Eightfold Path is a path of causation. So many of us think that we develop the Eightfold Path like an eight-lane highway. Now we do. We don't have to perfect one part of the Eightfold Path before moving on to the next. But In their development, it is sequential. It begins, of course, with right view of causation. And so that right view in the beginning is an intellectual right view. It's a proposition. It's a hypothesis. And one that we can gain confidence in through the application. So based upon that right view, we develop intentions. So we have our hypothesis and we have our parameters of our experiment and we put them into place through right intention. We watch our mind, make sure our intentions are in conformity with the Dhamma. And through that, we practice the right speech, the right conduct, and the right livelihood, the moral discipline. And with the mind that is purified at that point, we have greater confidence in right view. We have greater confidence that wholesome intentions lead to wholesome states of mind, even with just the moral discipline. And that is why we rejoice. The instructions after we have practiced the moral discipline is to notice within ourselves the bliss that is blameless. We rejoice because the hypothesis seems to be proven. That leads to confidence, sada and pali. Confidence, faith. Maybe the more faithful are okay with the word faith, but confidence is just fine. Confidence in the Buddha's teaching. Wow, we found something that works. That's right. That brings up a feeling of gladness within us, pamoja. That feeling of gladness is a worldly feeling. We feel glad when we've done a good job at work. We feel glad when we attend a family event and everybody's very happy. We feel glad when we recollect our own purity, our own generosity. We feel glad when we let go of a hindrance and feel the relief that that brings to the mind. But it's a quality of gladness at first, which we encounter in the world. Our normal everyday mind can feel glad like that without being on a meditation retreat, without practicing meditation. The next step, once we have the stability of the virtues and the gladness, is the right effort, of course. And that's not to let an unwholesome thought arise, which has not yet arisen. Not to let an unwholesome thought continue, which has arisen. Relax after we release that unwholesomeness. To make a wholesome thought arise, which has not yet arisen, the gladness. And to make that continue as long as we can. And if we fall off of that, to apply the six R's, the right effort to bring us back. So now we can see that we have a sequence in the Noble Eightfold Path. The next step is right mindfulness. And right mindfulness refers back to right effort. So when we are rightly mindful, it means that when whatever happens in front of us occurs, we make a judgment about whether it's wholesome or unwholesome. We recognize whether it's the object of meditation or not the object of meditation, or if it's a hindrance, so that's the recognize. And we apply the right effort. We release our attention from that. We relax. We bring up something wholesome, the smile. We feel glad inside, even for a moment, even a particle of gladness, and we continue with that feeling. That is the metta. That is how the metta begins. The metta begins as gladness. The warm feeling in our chest, when we say, visualize holding a puppy, holding your child, doing something wonderful, a memory from childhood. Again, these are things that we experience in ordinary everyday life. So we're still outside of the meditative context. But if we are rightly mindful, meaning we apply right effort to the situation in front of us, samadhi will arise. And that's why in the Great 40, in Majjhima Nikaya number 117, it said that all previous seven factors in sequence support right concentration, samadhi. Samadhi is a result. You can't make a result happen. You can make causes happen, but you can't make a result happen. Samadhi is the result of correctly practicing the seven previous steps of the Noble Eightfold Path. being rightly mindful, applying the six R's. Then samadhi just happens. We don't have to make jhana come up. Jhana comes up naturally if we follow the instructions. If we want jhana, jhana doesn't happen because there's craving in that. If you have been sticking to the Noble Eightfold Path, then the jhanas will be available to you because it's an outcome of that chain of causation. If the jhanas are not available to you, it's because of wrong practice of that chain of causation. You can be quite sure of that. If the jhanas do not arise, it's because gladness has not arisen. If gladness has not arisen, it's because you are engaging in activities that make you remorseful and tight in mind. And if you're doing that, you've lost your right intention. And if you are doing that, it means at some point you've lost right view. You've, through negligence, through not paying attention, you've failed to recognize at all times that the intentions of your mind create your mind states, have resultants. You've forgotten the law of karma. So, we aren't going to crave for jhana. Jhana is not the object of meditation, but it is important that we know what these factors are so we can know where we are in the meditation. If we don't know where we are in the meditation, we have this tendency to try to overdo things and to lose confidence and to wander and to dip into sloth and torpor. We should know where we are. So continuing with the gradual training, the Buddha gives similes for the jhanas, and some people learn well by a simile. And so these similes I find are very profound because they very precisely describe what is happening in the meditation when you stay with your object of meditation, whether that's metta, whether that's any object of meditation, these similes apply. I'll read to you.
Could you tell us what you're going to be, what sutta these are?
Sure. So this is the gradual training which appears in many, many suttas. I'm reading from Asapura, from the Greater Discourse at Asapura, Majjhima Nikaya number 39. Having abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a monk enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by here translated applied and sustained thought with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Seclusion from what? Seclusion from sensual pleasures and unwholesome states. So this is rapture and pleasure born of the successful seclusion from those states. So perhaps we should begin with rapture. The reason why I like translating the word piti as rapture is because it distinguishes it from gladness, which is pamoja. And it is also the gateway into the meditative state. As I've said, we experience gladness on a daily basis outside of the meditation. We experience even the warmth in our hearts outside of the meditation. Many people have experienced it. That's the initial instruction. Recall a time when you felt warm in your heart. You may not have even known about meditation. And you're like, oh, I can remember that and I can bring up the warmth. But here rapture arises. So rapture is a physical sensation. It's usually very pleasant, usually very, very pleasant. It can be so pleasant that it can be overpowering and then become unpleasant, but usually that won't happen with this method. But what characterizes it? Movement. Energetic movement. People feel it as zinging, going through their body, electricity. People feel it as goose pimples. People feel it as energy going up the spine, tingles. People very often feel it, especially breath meditators, in the hands. The hands are just alive and tingling with this energy. This is not the object of meditation in TWIM. The object of the meditation in TWIM, let me underline it, is metta, the gladness. So we will have the warmth in the heart, and somewhere in the body or in that warmth itself, there will be a lot of movement. If it's in the warmth, it will feel bubbling or like it's flowing or pouring out or tingling. That is the rapture. But you could feel the warmth in the chest and feel the tingling and the energy going up your arms, going up your legs. It just has movement. That is the hallmark of PT. It has energetic movement. Along with that is pleasure. Now, the pleasure that we have with metta is the pleasure of the loving kindness feeling itself. And so we have this rapture, which is a break from the ordinary sensations that we have, although not 100%. Did you see a beautiful mind? So there's a time when, what's his name? Who's the main?
John Nash.
John Nash, right? So there's a time where he has an epiphany and the music picks up and he starts writing furiously on the board. And then everybody in the audience has this tingle going up their spine because they're with him, right? They're with him in this enthusiasm, the tingle going up the spine. Hearing a very deeply moving piece of music, the rising action of a drama, practically this energy lifts you off your seat a little bit if it's very strong. That's rapture. Ordinarily, we do not feel this. Rare moments in the world when we feel this level of enthusiasm, this level of energetic movement. But this is the hallmark of the first jhana. We know that we are entering the meditation proper when this arises. Concomitant with the rapture and with the pleasure, the metta in the chest, there will be vitaka, vichara in Pali, here translated applied and sustained thought. Or Lee Brazington translates it thinking and more thinking, or thinking and evaluating. The mind will still be thinking, there will still be verbalizing. The mind should not be thinking of or verbalizing unwholesome things. Stray unwholesome things may be happening, stray thoughts of ill will, but if you are in a state, as I described, if you are in a state of ill will, jhanas are not going to arise. But if you just have stray thoughts happening or even loud thoughts, especially about the object of meditation, am I on it? Am I not on it? Ooh, what's this electric feeling that's happening in my body? What's this pleasant feeling over here? So the mind is verbalizing about its own experience. There is a sutta that says that vitaka and vichara, this thinking, has to do with the object of meditation. So generally it has to do with the object of meditation, whether or not you're on the object of meditation, because there's so much going on in the first jhana. The first jhana is not a restful state. It is not a unified state. Samadhi is not a factor of the first jhana. I call it the ordeal of jhana. In the Christian mystical tradition, we see this ordeal very much in the Grail romances. If anybody knows anything about the Grail romances, the stories of the quest for the Grail. The knight must at some point experience a wounding. Why is that? Because in our ordinary everyday life, for me, I have my views, I have my opinions, I have my emotions. I'm in my ordinary mind and there isn't space for anything else. So this wounding, sometimes it's the king who's become ill and the knight has to go find the Grail to heal the king, right? But some wounding is involved. The wounding opens the space so that new things can enter. We have to open a space within us for something new, for a novel experience to enter. What this rapture does is it opens that space for us. The first jhana is very much about opening the space, and it's an ordeal. In some of the Grail romances, it involves an actual cutting, an actual wound that the knight receives. to have the divine presence, to have the great experience, we have to empty ourselves. In the Christian terminology, it's known as kenosis, self-emptying. We have to empty ourselves of all ego, of all senses, of all thoughts, in order for what is not samsara to appear. We are creatures composed of samsara, of suffering. We have to tranquilize all of that before we can let the greater experience in. With all this lumen and abuzzing happening in the first jhana, you're going to get knocked off your object of meditation, inevitably. You siksar, you come back. What have you just done? You've reapplied yourself to the object of meditation, and you sustain your attention on the object of meditation. So in that sense, we have an initial application to the object of meditation, the metta, and a sustained application to the object of meditation. So we can say that that's also there. So here's the simile for the first jhana. The meditator makes the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion drench, steep, fill, and pervade the body, so that there is no part of the whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Just as a skilled bathman or a bathman's apprentice heaps bath powder in a metal basin and, sprinkling it gradually with water, kneads it until the moisture wets this ball of bath powder, soaks it and pervades it inside and out, yet the ball itself does not ooze. So too, a monk makes the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of this whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Now, this would be easiest to understand if one were using the jhanic factors as the object of meditation directly, which is a method. Here, when we're using the metta, the same principle applies. We are reapplying ourselves to the metta, to the warm feeling in our chest over and over again. Again, because the buzzing and the blooming of the first jhana just distracts us continuously. That is actually the nature of the first jhana, to have that movement in it. And that movement inevitably jostles the mind. We are doing the work in this simile of unifying the mind. Our mind ordinarily is like a sack of flour that has been broken open onto the counter. It's desiccated, dry, likely to fly apart everywhere at the slightest gust of wind. What we're trying to do is to unify the mind. And so by reapplying our attention to the object of meditation, to the metta, we are kneading the mind together into this unified state. The rapture is the sprinkling. That's how it feels, isn't it? The sprinkling is a movement. When you feel it sprinkling, you feel little dots of moisture all over your skin. Or when it's raining, you're actually getting pummeled with the raindrops, right? And PT can be like that too. Can be pummeled with it. But it's a sort of pulsating thing, drop after drop. So that's the sprinkling. And the sprinkling is happening, and the dryness is coming together, being moistened. We are, as dry, tired beings, being fulfilled, being filled with this moisture of metta, of sukha, of gladness, of happiness, of love. And that is bringing us together, bringing the mind together. It's not scattering off in all directions like dry flour. That is the action of the first jhana. Yes, watch the metta, whatever it does, it does. But if you are on the metta with your spiritual friend and you get the PT, the rapture arising, and then it fades away and then you start dulling out, losing interest, you need to take more interest in your spiritual friend. You need to be more sincere. So the sincerity with which you are on your object of meditation, the genuineness of the feeling of metta will be revealed to you by the arising of piti. This is why it's important that we know what the jhanic factors are and what the jhanas are doing. Because if you're just sitting there dully, may you be happy, may you be loved, and the spiritual friend is out there in the heart, and it feels nice, you know, I'm not thinking. You're not putting your best foot forward, and you're not really genuine about what you're doing. You're just sort of hanging out and relaxing. And that's not going to bring jhana. It's not going to be progress in the teaching, let's put it that way.
The sincerity, do you have any advice on, like, you know, how to, like, have more sincerity? Is it, like, more interest in, like, what you're doing?
Yes. So it may be, if you're having a long-term problem with insincerity, it may be important after half an hour to get up, take a walk, breathe, get your energy back up. Because it's said that concentration takes away energy. Now, this is a part of the Visuddhimagga that I don't agree with. Okay. But it is correct in a certain sense. When you're in the state of not really feeling the metta, but you're using the phrases and you're trying to be with your spiritual friend, but you're not really feeling anything, you are burning through energy. You are burning through mental energy. It does make you dull. And so you will need to make sure you get enough sleep. You need to watch eating and not eat too much. Eat just enough so that old feelings of hunger subside and new feelings of sluggishness do not arise, as the instruction says. But until this rapture arises, the process of meditation is taking energy from you. When rapture arises, after rapture arises, you have an output of energy. It's like fusion, right? You put in, it takes all this energy to put in to create fusion. It's not even worth it. So we're trying to look for a way to have a positive balance of energy come out of this reaction. That's when the first jhana is, when energy comes out of the reaction. Does that answer your question? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You mentioned that metta and the piti are not the same thing?
No.
Oh, okay, so I might be confused. So sometimes it's like a, how do you say it? Mm-hmm. Is that the metta or the piti?
The vibration is piti, but is there a warmth of opening, a sincerity of love along with the vibration?
If I rest my attention on the vibration long enough, that kind of happens.
Okay. So the vibration then may not be piti, but whatever it is, if it brings up the warmth, that's important. We really do want to feel the warmth in our chest. Otherwise, it's a thinking game and not a feeling game. And so we want to feel the warmth. And with that warmth, as I said, you may feel a bubbling. You may feel an energy out rushing through you. Through that warmth, you may feel the warmth flooding into places in your body. The movement is the PT. The movement is the PT.
So are they related?
Right. So they are separate factors, but the gladness of the warmth, if you keep your mind on that, it secludes you from sensual desire and unwholesome states. And that allows you to be sensitive to the movement. But the warmth, the gladness, is the proximate cause, Upanisa, the proximate cause of the PT is the gladness. The warmth. Yeah. Maybe you're feeling a little gladness and warmth that you're not sensitive to, and that's why, and then the vibration comes up and you can feel that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between Pamoja and Sukha? It's a good question. Degree. So the Pamoja and the Sukha are related. a lot of words can be used interchangeably in the canon. When I say he experiences within himself a bliss that is blameless after one experiences the noble aggregate of virtue, when one's virtuous or one's secluded from the hindrance, the word sukha is used there, but what's meant is pamoja, because later on in the summary, the introductory summary of the jhanas, it said the thing we chant in the morning, a person who is glad feels rapture. Enraptured, one feels pleasure, or one feels tranquility. When one feels tranquility, one feels sukha. One feels happy. So these factors will unify in the second jhana, which we may not get to today. So it'll become more clear what the metta aligns to in the second jhana, because all these factors are going to become unified in the mind. But the piti, the movement, is not the metta. Follow up?
Questions.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So the feeling within the body of metta, that is a resultant of the intention or thought of metta, is that correct?
It can be, yes. So it's the resultant of the right intention built on right view, and then you have right conduct, right speech, right livelihood. Your right speech is may you be happy, may you be loved. So the gladness is the outcome of the virtue.
The feeling of metta. So if I'm in meditation, I get off of that feeling. I may need to bring up the intention again to bring that feeling back. So when I'm off the... when I 6R, if there's no feeling there, I have to start again with the intention of metta, is that right?
Yes, unless when you smile, it brings it up. And very often, just remembering to re-smile makes the heart warm. If you smile now, if you're enjoying yourself, you'll notice a little opening warmth in the heart.
I just wondered if you could tie in a skillful understanding of using the walking, and maybe even brisk walking, and periods of that to balance the energy because of the expenditure of energy in sitting, and then using the walking, but keeping the meditation continuity going. Because the walking is just as important as the sitting.
Yes, especially again, since the meditation consumes energy until the jhanas arise, then the walking becomes especially important because the walking picks the energy up. But on the walking, we don't want to let our mind go back to work and fights we've had with people at work, or things that are happening at work, or things that we see along the trail. Oh, somebody left a piece of garbage in this beautiful setting, and it's only $1,000 fine, and why isn't it the death penalty? So we want to bring, we want to keep our spiritual friend and our metta with us while we're walking. So smile, keep warmth in the heart while you're walking. Very important. It can happen during a walk, for sure. It can happen when you're hearing a beautiful piece of music. If you take your mind off of the music itself and put it on the sensation that you're feeling, the opening, the love, the piti, that can take you into jhana. Lots of things can be a prompt to gladness. It's about the gladness. It's about the purity of Pamoja, of gladness. If we stay with that gladness, the dhanas will arise. We just have to apply the six R's, stay with the gladness. The jhanas are a result. It's part of the reason, again, that we don't talk about jhanas very much on the twin retreat, because we are staying with the causes, the Brahmaviharas, the object of meditation, and we're not trying to make results happen. You can't make a result happen. You can only make a cause happen.
So how essential is it that you feel this pity in order to advance? Because in certain instances, I understand it might not arise for some.
Yes. So with metta, you can glide straight into the second jhana and bypass the first. That's not unheard of. It's actually very common. Because I was going to do second jhana, we'll do it tomorrow. Because the feeling of metta has very much in common with the piti sukha born of samadhi. So piti and sukha are still present in the second jhana, but it's much softer, much gentler, and the mind is still and starts to become pervaded by it, tranquilized by it, one could say. And there the metta and the piti sukha come together beautifully. And so if the metta is really there and you're radiating to your spiritual friend, which is movement, then you could just go straight into the second jhana and it becomes very quiet. Difference between second jhana and first jhana is there's no more talking. There's no more vitaka vichara, no more, I mean, stray here and there. But as you go deeper into the retreat and your mind settles down and you're not talking to others and you're not checking your phone and you're not criticizing yourself so much, the mind just does it without talking.
Most of the time you mentioned metta as the object of attention. Then you mentioned the Brahmaviharas as maybe an option or something that we can play with at some point. In other words, is there, maybe as we get better, we can use Karuna and Mudita?
Right.
Yes. You know, what's the relationship there?
Yeah, so of course, metta being the first Brahmavihara. In this method, metta transforms naturally into compassion. So we don't have to, we don't play with them. We don't go back and forth. Today I do equanimity, tomorrow I do karuna. Metta naturally flows into compassion.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm like trying not to force it, but is that okay? Because that seems different than say when like something out of the six R pops up, like a past experience, like a recollection, or something I have to do, like I have an appointment coming up, or some kind of distraction.
Restlessness and worry would be the appointment coming up.
Okay.
Only if it takes you off the sensation of metta. If your attention is on the sensation of metta and you're talking and giving advice to how your friend's face should be, fine. Don't 6R. Only if, because you're going to in the background start verbalizing about the experience that you're having. That's natural. That's called the verbal formation. We are composed of three formations that need to be brought to stillness, tranquility, cessation, the verbal formation, the bodily formation, and the mental formation. The purpose of the second jhana, when second jhana is achieved, it silences the verbal formation. When the fourth jhana is achieved, it silences the bodily formation. And when cessation is achieved, it silences the mental formation. Just a progressive collapse, and that tells us how coarse indeed talking is. It's more coarse than the body, if you can believe it.
Rachel, do you have a set of favorite images? images or techniques to strengthen the connection with the spiritual friend? I mean, do you visualize, do you feel this heart-to-heart, you know, golden cord?
Oh, you want my secret.
Or secrets.
Sure. Well, I can't tell you what I do, but I can tell you things that are available. How about that?
No, that's fine.
Yeah, yeah. So if you're a visual person, visualizing this ball of light in your chest, the sun, one of my favorite meditations, well, I'm getting into my secrets then. My favorite guided meditation by the Venerable Ayakema is the sun in your heart meditation. Of course, if it's the sun shines, as she says later, indiscriminately. She says that when we get to the people we don't like, because we don't want the sun to shine on them, then we have to remind ourselves that the sun doesn't share our opinion, it just shines. So we can let that light reach out like a beam to the spiritual friend. We can put the spiritual friend in the ball of light. We do want to have some, it doesn't have to be literal distance, but we want to have some kind of separation between us and the spiritual friend so that we can make the connection with the spiritual friend through metta. The metta is what joins us, this lovely beam of light. The Tibetans are experts at this. They have a practice called Tonglen, sending and receiving. It's a wonderful practice. One of my favorites is something called the Jewel Tree Meditation. You imagine that there's this lovely tree in front of you, giant supernatural tree extending up into the sky, and you populate it with all your gurus, all the wonderful images of perfection, and they smile on you, and you feel their blessings, and they fill you with their blessings, and it's like a light coming at you and entering you through the top of your head, filling you up, and then in front of you is your spiritual friend, and you send it to them. And then you're sitting at the center of a circuit, which is wonderful. You're receiving and you're giving. Tonglen, sending, receiving. It's a lovely practice. If you're not visual, the phrases help, right? If you're more of a verbal person, the phrases might bring it up. If you're a feeler, just remembering the feeling, putting your hands on your chest to actually, oh, that's what warmth feels like. Or for a moment going out into the courtyard and allowing the sun to strike your chest for a good 5-10 minutes. Oh, that's what that feels like, right? We don't want it to strike the rest of us because we lose the gradient, and the gradient's important to feel it, feel the metta in the chest. Lots of different methods for metta.
So I'm doing the practice wrong. I think I've been just watching the PT instead of the loving kindness. And so when I like basically smile, I can kind of feel like a warm contentedness. That's it. But so here's what I was doing before, right? And I think this is wrong. I was watching the PT, and then it would move up eventually, but I guess that's not what I'm supposed to be watching.
Right? It's the warm contentedness.
The warm. But yeah. That's much, much more subtle.
Yes. Not as much fun, huh?
It's, I guess, more powerful, but it's also easier to lose. So.
Yes. It is a seed, and your attention is the water.
Okay.
Give it your attention, and it will grow.
Okay.
Yes. It's love. It's metta. It's unconditional love. Not movement. It's love. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, one that I do actually have is you said you can't share your secrets. And I was curious if that's because you find there's some sort of value in not talking about one of your like special moves, or if there's
up, down, right?
I'm looking for that.
Yes, exactly. AB. No, I was joking. But the reason why it's my special secret is really because it works for me and may not work for you.
I have a question about the spiritual friend, because I think most of the talks so far have really focused on that, and I don't remember that being a critical part of the instruction on previous retreats. I've spaced it out. So how long do I keep my spiritual friend with me? When do I let my spiritual friend go?
So as I said, 90%, and this is not exact, but the vast majority of your attention should be on the feeling, the sensation of metta. The spiritual friend is just present. You maybe visualize the person, maybe not, but don't put a lot of energy into visualizing. We're not doing Tibetan to visualization practice. And just offer. The spiritual friend is a prompt to keeping the metta going, because having a friend there makes you feel good, we're social creatures. Generosity, giving it. And the giving it makes it flow, which, that's movement, isn't it? It's very much like the factor, it's very much like the first jhana, right? When we get this movement going, if you feel a flow out of your chest, that's piti. When the spiritual friend should go. The instruction will change when your body disappears.
Okay.
So until the body disappears, spiritual friend.
Okay, great. And then that flow, that sharing, that part of the radiating?
That is the radiating.
That is the radiating, okay. Okay.
Clear? You can ask again.
With that, and we'll talk.
Okay. I saw a flurry of other hands. Yes. The importance of metta, again, is that it's part of, with the jhanas, this path called liberation of the heart, chetto vimutti, the heart being here in the center of the chest. Metta as an object of meditation is in the center of the chest. The jhanas, well, the home base of tranquility in the second jhana is also felt in the center of the chest. When you're on the breath, the breath is wonderful, but it's not intrinsically related to the jhanas the way metta is. The other thing is that as social creatures, as I just mentioned, and just as creatures, we all want to be loved. And in the normal means of fulfilling that need, we love things of this world, people that are subject to change. And so behind that love is the anxiety of loss. So the love is impure. Because if you love somebody with the kind of love that requires them to stay, you put a burden on the other person and you put conditions on your love. If you love somebody because it's a quality of your own heart, then it takes the edge off of, you must be this way for me, you must stay. You must always love me because you swore on a stack of Bibles 20 years ago that you would forever and ever. So it takes the edge off of the burden. It's a practice, not a perfection, but metta helps me perfect it.